I'm Christopher Lydon with the novelist Dennis Lehane, the reigning king of Boston noir, pronounced noir when his characters move out of books into major movies like Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone, and Shutter Island. Moonlight Mile is Dennis Lehane's new novel, detective fiction with a social edge. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the multiple layers of meaning and the multimedia that a gifted writer finds himself exploring still early in an ambitious career. We met Dennis Lehane in his kind of place, an Italian restaurant called Mother Anna's in Boston's North End. Dennis Lehane, you hooked me, might have been 15 years ago on the radio, with a story about coming out of college and vowing that you would never take a job that could distract you from being a writer. No law school, no journalism, security guys or whatever.
Yeah.
It was the mark of a serious writer in the making, I thought.
Or a really stupid one, but it worked. In my case, it worked out, you know. You know what it is there's a logic. Certainly in academia, when I came out of grad school, and everybody goes into teaching jobs. And the theory is that you'll teach, and then that will give you time to write. But the reality is teaching is a hell of a lot more than a 40-hour week, particularly at an adjunct level if you're an adjunct professor. And I just saw the writing on the wall and said, I don't want to read 160 bad papers a week. I don't want to teach six classes. I don't want to teach 160 students and then try and write. I won't be in the mood. So I'd rather park cars, which is what I was doing, I think. Maybe when we met. I'd rather park cars. I'd rather drive limos. I'd rather do anything that I don't take home with me.
You were writing stories about cops in those days. You're writing novels that Martin Scorsese turns into movies nowadays. It's a big move. But let me just say, for the hood, we're proud of you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, it's nice.
And we're proud that you keep this Boston noir thing going.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Oh, now it's gotten to where, you know, if anything shows up where somebody's got a gun and there's a bar in it, I get thanked for it. I mean, I can't tell you how many people come up and thank me for writing The Departed. You know, it's nonstop, you know. And then somebody came up and thanked my wife recently tell him thanks for writing The Town. I was like, I didn't write The Town. I didn't write The Departed. You know what I mean? Departed was a guy named Bill Monahan. You know, The Town was based on a novel by Chuck Hogan, who's, you know, somebody I know, and Ben Affleck and some other people wrote the script. So, but it doesn't matter. If there's a gun in it and a bar, people think I wrote it.
There's a gift in there that keeps on giving, and I'm still not clear what it is. It's something to do with Catholic guilt and Irish wit and who knows what else.
You know, here's the thing. As this country gets more and more and more homogenized and more bland and more on what Tom Wolfe said, you can only tell that the neighborhoods have changed by the next 7-Eleven, the more that becomes this country, a place that is this unique, I mean, in speech, in sense of humor, and in the ability of people to just get in your face. I mean, all of this is just, I love it, man. And it's just endless for me. People say, will you write anything set anyplace else? Why? You know, I've set things some other places. I mean, I set a good portion of The Given Day in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I spent several of my short stories have been spent in the South. But at the end of the day, this is home. This is a really rich and fertile ground to write from.
I especially want to sort of open up Shutter Island and the new one, Moonlight Mile. They're in Boston. They're not of Boston. Though. There's something much bigger and deeper, maybe especially Shutter Island.
Mystic River, I would say, is a book that uses Boston as a microcosm. It's not, you know what I mean? It's meant to be looking at a larger issue, or several larger issues. Shutter Island is a gothic. It could have been set anywhere, but it's set, you know, off the coast of Hull. Gone Baby Gone, yeah. Gone Baby Gone, I was very clearly, I think, and in Moonlight Mile, I was trying to stretch the genre. I was just trying to see, in that case, the PI genre. I was just trying to see what I could do with the form, you know, because I think it's in danger of extinction. I'm not sure how many more people are going to write PI novels after a certain point. I don't see too many young 20-somethings coming up believing in the genre.
Can I try out the notion that Shutter Island is about many, many things, but big issues, including the borderline of the criminal and the insane, the borderline of a cop who killed his wife and a cop who's looking for killers. In some ways, I especially saw the movie as a metaphor of somewhere between the Cold War and the War on Terror, having some vague suggestion of Guantanamo, too.
I will say that I wasn't thinking of Guantanamo when I wrote it. I was very much thinking of the Patriot Act when I wrote it. I was very angry about the Patriot Act.
Yeah, spell it out.
Well, it was a new McCarthyism, and I started to say, if they can start changing what we say, then they will ultimately be able to change how we think. That's the hideousness of Stalinism. And McCarthyism, to me, is a type of Stalinism. And so when I saw the Patriot Act and I saw what they were asking us to give up in terms of our civil liberties, I got very angry. And I said, all right, I'm going to set a book during McCarthy. And I'm going to have it be about the price of repression on every level that I can find. And that really becomes what the book is about. It's about the systematic sort of disintegration of a person's mind because of repression.
I took it that Teddy Cophead was a fiction and that Andrew, who had killed his family, was the reality.
Yeah.
And yet the whole movie is about the borderline.
Sure, sure. He's either paranoid or everybody is out to get him. It's one way or the other. And the whole thing is this is my one law. I don't do it. I don't do it for my wife, so I won't do it for you. I never explain the ending of Shutter Island. I won't do it. I won't tell you how to feel. I won't tell anybody. It's just, it's cooler when you get to argue about it. It's cooler.
It's a lot
when
cooler.
You get to, yeah. So
most people I know think he was Teddy.
A lot of people. It's amazing how many people think, you know, yeah, he's. They really are out to get him. You know. So.
And yet the movie is taking you into a zone of complete control by either doctors or cops, crazy men or saints. There's a lot about the world we live in right there.
Yeah. There's a really crucial scene in both the book and the movie. And it was funny because one review of the movie said, Scorsese gets this scene in a way I don't think Lehane intends. And it was the only thing that really kind of PO'd me. I was like, why do you think I put it in there? Of course I intended it. And it's the scene where a guy attacks Teddy in the mental institution. And he jumps on him. He starts talking about the hydrogen bomb tests and how an H-bomb works and how it doesn't explode. It implodes. Sucks all the energy around it in. And I think if you can run with that in terms of what the movie's saying and the book is saying, both politically and also, I don't want to just write a polemic. I don't believe in them. But it's saying something's politically, something's socially. It's also saying something's hopefully about the human condition and about, you know, and that's what you're hoping for.
The same characters are speaking about psychotropic drugs, experiments, playing with people's minds. This was reality in the Cold War, but it's also Guantanamo. It's also War on Terror.
You know, you see, I was famously experimenting with psychotropic drugs in mental institutions in the 1950s. Not just mental institutions, college campuses.
Prisons,
hospitals, people just coming in off the streets answering newspaper ads. That was another thing that was being done. So they just wanted to see, boy, what can we do with this LSD? What can we do with this? Let's just see. What does it do? Can we use it on enemy combatants? And then they found out, no, it just makes people go absolutely insane if they don't know they're on it. There was some very ugly damage being done to the populace. And I think that that's also something that we have to keep remembering is at the end of the day, there's a large and functioning apparatus in any government, in any country, that believes that people are guinea pigs. And you see it time and time again. You know, we'll lose a few, but that's okay. We're okay with that. We need to get to this objective. And I don't think it's any clearer right now than in the mortgage crisis and the subprime crisis. I mean, you know, there are people who are being destroyed. There is no question. There is death. There is blood all over these people's hands, and nobody cares. Absolutely, do not care. They tried. They rolled the dice. They were wrong. They move on. It's also what we do to our kids. That's not a mistake either. There's one point where It's a line I was so hoping would make the movie, and it didn't. We tried to get it in there. We tried, but it just wouldn't work. There's a line in the book where the doctor says, we're going to get to the point where we medicate the human experience out of human experience.
Mm.
And I think that's very true in terms of when you see six-year-olds on Ritalin, we have seriously effed up. There's no, you can't make an argument to me that a six-year-old should be on Ritalin. You make an argument that a 10-year-old of a certain type should be on Ritalin, but not six-year-olds. And we've done that now because nobody wants to do their job as parents. So just, to, you know, oh, he's hyperactive. No, he's five. He's not hyperactive. He has ADHD. No, he's five. He's a five-year-old boy. But, you know, parents don't want to deal with the stress of their kids. They throw them on drugs. I think it's really revolting.
How much do you know, Dennis, about the war on terror drugs and interrogation and not to mention long-term lockups? And
oh, I mean, enough to – you throw out habeas corpus, you throw out everything that we stand for as a country. You know, the founding fathers are rolling over in their graves with what went on at Guantanamo. They're rolling over their graves with what went on, you know, in terms of a lot of the war on terror. Mm-hmm. However, there are also lines – and there are lines that are interesting to me as a dramatist that I have not entered, I have not investigated. But in The Given Day, I think I did a little bit. Where do you want the line to be drawn? I think we can all agree that there should be special, there are special legal considerations in a time of war. There is no question about that. But it's just like not these. You know what I mean? Not the one. You know, there are cases where you say no. You are going to be tried by a military tribunal. You're not to be tried in a civil court. I mean, not a civil court. You're not going to be tried in you know, by a jury, for example. This is a different issue. And in time of war, I do agree with that. We're not, you know, what's really depressing about the way that the language was co-opted during the war on terror was that the people who were not really fighting the war on terror but said they were would attack people who stood up for the true America. The Constitution. At the same time, and then they would say you're weak on terrorists. I'm not weak on terrorists. I'm not remotely weak on terrorists. I would have a very clear sense that they should be treated exactly as, say, Nazis were treated at the end of World War II, in which case there was very quick hangings at the end of World War II. That's not the issue. The issue is when you just round people up, throw them into Guantanamo, give them no rights, give them no access to attorneys, torture them, give them psychotropic drugs, waterboard them, and leave them there to rot, and you don't even know who they are. They'll tell you anything after a certain point. It's not like we grabbed, well, who's the Egyptian who's second in command to Bin Laden?
Al-Zawahiri.
Okay, you grab him, you throw him in a hole, I don't have a problem with that. You are an enemy combatant. I do not have a problem with that. You grab some stranger off the street who may have talked to somebody who may have had access to weapons-grade anthrax, maybe, or didn't, or could have, or should have. You ship him 90 miles away to Cuba, and you throw him in a tank. That's a violation of every single thing we stand for as a country, and it should make us all want to vomit. Are we the only... there seem to be only a few people who are worried that we're selling out the entire country, that everything's gone, that the America that we knew growing up is just vanishing, and not vanishing in the way that the fringe right-wingers want you to believe, that we can get back to some idealistic 1950s that never existed. But it's more this thing of isn't anybody paying attention? They destroyed there's no more unions left. They're destroyed. After they went after the unions, then they just outsourced everything. So now there's no jobs left. Now they got the people who have lost all their jobs, lost their houses, lost everything, believing that the reason that they've lost it is everything but the real reasons that they have. And everybody just seems to say, fine, as long as I can get things for $3, you know, $3 a can at Walmart, I'm okay. And I think we're just watching America fiddle while it burns. I really feel that.
Dennis, I hear you say you don't want to write obvious polemics, and you don't, but did people get Shutter Island, do you think? I wondered.
At that level? I don't think so. The French did, which was very interesting. The French totally got it. Do people get it? No. Should they get it? Do they need to get it? No. My desire was, when I wrote that book, was very specifically to model it after B-movies of the 50s that people didn't get for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Movies like Night of the Hunter, Manchurian Candidate. Manchurian Candidate is still the single greatest political movie ever made.
Amen. Thank you.
And is so prescient. I mean, you look at the noise machine that's out there now, which is there's a moment in the Manchurian Candidate where the McCarthy character says, who's just a weak, ineffectual guy, turns to his wife, Angela Lansbury, the great evil Angela Lansbury, and says, babe, they're making fun of me. Are there 33 communists or are there 43 communists in the House of Representatives? And she says, never you mind. Are they saying, are there any communists? No. They're just arguing about the numbers. And if that doesn't just sum up, you know, the way that the noise machine is out there now when they run out and they say, you know, the president's trip is costing $200 million, just get it out there. It doesn't matter that it's true or not. Just get it out there. His trip to China, Indonesia, is costing $200 million a day. Who cares if it's true? Who cares if we know it's true or it isn't true? He'll just spend all his time defending it, and we've won. And that, I think, is very depressing, and it's very depressing the way most of the media has rolled over. One of the things that I think is unfortunate, all societies do this, there's not a single society that doesn't have it. We all have our national myths, and America is really sucked into a mythology about itself that's not true and never has been. And I find it, everybody is desperate to get back to this idealized time, and what they're really wanting to get back to is their own childhoods. They want to get back to the world when they were 9 years old. So you have idiots like, there's no other word for them. You have an idiot like Glenn Beck talking about the wonderful times in which he grew up. Wonderful times in which he grew up in the 1970s. There was nothing really wonderful about the 1970s. It wasn't Beaver Cleaverville. You know what I mean? It was riots in the streets. It was gas lines. It was a president leaving office in disgrace. It was a 1.5 year president who followed him. It was Iran. The 70s were a disaster. So what is everybody really dreaming about? What do they want to get back to? They want to get back to when they were children. It's the same thing with fundamentalism. I hate the term fundamentalism. You know, reading was fundamental. Things were fundamental when we were 7. 2 + 2 = 4. But hopefully you evolve past that. And I think this really deep anti-intellectual strain in America has gotten to where, where we look around and we just see those of us who might want to think see a lot of zombies. I don't know how else to put it. All past is prologue. I think it's central to a lot of art, particularly to noir. Noir is, without a doubt, the ultimate genre of you cannot outrun the past. It's no mistake, the greatest film noir is out of the past. You know, the past comes to get you. The greatest neo-noir, in my opinion, is a movie called One False Move, in which the past just keeps coming at this hero all through the movie. And in the end, he can't outrun it. You can't beat the Mystic River. You cannot outrun your nature. You cannot outrun your past. Cormac McCarthy has this great theory that about darkness and light. So if you read his books, you know how incredibly brutally dark they can be, particularly the early work like Blood Meridian, certainly in The Crossing. And the idea is that the more oppressive the darkness, the stronger the light that pops through must be. So that in the end, if any light gets through, it's extreme optimism. It's an extremely optimistic work, no matter how dark it is, that any light can push through. It means that the light just can't be vanquished. The darkness keeps losing if you look at it in the correct perspective. Because as long as people keep fighting, as long as people keep questioning, as long as people keep... there's something wonderful in that. The light that pushes up through the darkness is the most hopeful light.
We love novelists, Dennis, mainly because I think they are the anthropologists and even the journalists, but the historians that we'll trust in the long run. I'm fascinated with your Patrick and Angie, mm-hmm. and I wonder, in the new book, about everything they're going through.
They're stuck in the new economy, that's for sure.
For sure. Yeah. They're true to Dorchester and the urban scene, and yet Angie is out of the rough stuff in terms of detection. She's back in school. What are they going through?
they're going through a lot of things. They're going through the feeling that you have when you have a child, which is, do I still want to run around trying to pretend I'm a kid? That's not going to work anymore. They're beginning to question whether they should risk their lives when they have a child at home. Angie begins to question whether she even wants to be in contact with anybody who's in these sort of darker worlds that they uncover at various times. But Patrick is stuck the way most people are in the new economy. He's not the man he wanted to be anymore. He's working for a firm that he doesn't agree with what they do. He doesn't agree with his job for them, but he has no choice. He wants to get health benefits. He wants to get the 401k. He wants to get a permanent job. And he's got to do it because he has to put food on the table. And I think that makes him interesting in a way that he wasn't when I left the series. You know,
they're always interesting. I'm fascinated that, and this is not to call you Charles Dickens or...
Oh, please don't.
or the new book, Bleak House, either. But your Amanda is living out the puzzle of Bleak House, of Esther Summerson, the child of a wrong relationship who has found happiness in Jaundice's care.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
Unbelievable radiant happiness. Your Amanda makes a wonderful case that it doesn't matter where she was born, she found her home with Jack Doyle and his wife. It's a wonderful sort of anti-biological take on families and childhood and parenthood.
I think it's a recurrent theme in my books. I notice it's in The Given Day really strongly. It's a point where they talk about the two families, the one you're born into and the one you choose. There's a moment in Moonlight Mile where she says nature versus nurture. I'll take nurture every time.
Right. She says to Patrick, who had kidnapped her from her good parents and returned her to her mama from hell, she says, "Who were you to say where my home was? Dorchester was just where I was born. I was Helene's spawn, but I was Jack and Tricia Doyle's child."
Yeah. Yeah, but Patrick has to make a choice for... Patrick makes a choice at Gone Baby Gone, at the end of Gone Baby Gone, to return her to her legal mother, to the mother who gave birth to her. This is not something that's arbitrary. This is... he is standing in for society. We all make this choice. We make this choice every day. We would not be sitting there saying, should we allow every child who's unhappy with their parents to come forward and we'll adjudicate where they end up with, you know, with whom they end up to be raised by? That was terrible syntax, but you understand what I'm saying. I think that Patrick makes the choice that society makes. She has to go back with the mother who gave birth to her. That's how it works. The mother neglects her. But the mother doesn't necessarily beat her, so, and she shouldn't go with people who kidnapped her violently and left several people dead on the streets of Boston, you know?
Serious puzzle.
So it's the difference between going with your head and going with your heart, which is, you know, the sort of adult conflict, you know? As you're under the age of 20, you always go with your heart. I think that's an issue, but where do I stand... where do I stand emotionally? I think it's very clear where I stand. I think it's very clear in a lot of my books. I'm not a big believer in biology. It doesn't mean anything to me. It's wonderful. Bloodlines are great. Blood ties are great. But at the end of the day, what makes a parent, what makes a husband, what makes a good wife, what makes a good friend, what makes a good whatever, has nothing to do with biology. It's always about choices.
You say it recurs in your books. Which is to say, either you're repeating yourself or it comes from someplace very, very deep.
Yeah, it's an obsession. And we don't understand our obsessions usually with writers. If they're good, we don't get them. Normally most writers, I mean, you go through Graham Greene, you go through Dickens, you go through somebody who has a body of work, you're going to see central obsession keep popping up, keep popping up in their work. So I think that one of the things that shows up in my work a lot is that question. Is what is the definition of family? You know, so.
Does it change? And do you know when you started asking it or why?
Oh, I think I started asking the very first book. You see, Patrick and Angie and Bubba are like the little rascals. They were really raised by no one. You know, they're like Charlie Brown. The parents don't show up much, you know, and when they do, they're bad, which has nothing to do with my own personal autobiography, but it was something that just became a fascination for me as the books went on. And I think it probably stems from having worked with so many kids who were so damaged by their parents as a counselor. I just thought, wow, did I dodge the bullet?
Where'd you work with them?
I was a therapeutic counselor with abused children in Florida for several years. That's what probably got me going on that track. And it was just a sense of being very aware that I dodged a bullet. It's a parental lottery. That's what it comes down to. And a lot of people, they just lose the parental lottery. And I, so.
I'd love to know, Dennis, what it's like to go from working on these books one by one to imagining them in the hands of Clint Eastwood or Martin Scorsese. What happens?
What's it like? It's great. I mean, you know, it's been a wonderful ride. What I've been lucky enough to do, and the one place where I do take credit, is I've chosen people based on their work. I've not sold to a studio. I have once, but it was a bad, bad mistake, and I got the rights back and never did it again. I don't sell to studios. I don't sell to the corporation. I sell to the artist, and a producer can be an artist, a really good producer. So I sold to Clint Eastwood, who's a producer-director. I sold to Alan Ladd for Gone Baby Gone. He's a producer, produced Blade Runner, produced Chariots of Fire, Braveheart. And I sold to Mike Medavoy and Bradley Fisher, who are a producing team, and they produced what I think is the finest movie of this decade, which was Zodiac, David Fincher's Zodiac. They also produced People versus Larry Flint, Mike Medavoy's produced Platoon, Silence of the Lambs, Apocalypse Now, you name it. So I knew that artistically I was in good hands.
And they did Shutter Island?
They did Shutter Island. And they went out and they found Lita Calagritis. Brad Fisher found Lita Calagritis, and she wrote the script. And that script attracted DiCaprio, and DiCaprio handed it to Scorsese, and the rest is history, as they say. So
that's the way it goes. I just feel DiCaprio gave you a tremendous summer's work, or whatever it was.
He sure did. He sure did. You know what performance is? I mean, I love Leo's performance in that film. I think he owns it. But the performance I am just continually amazed by is Mark Ruffalo's. The sidekick. Because if you watch,
or the doctor,
watch the performance again, and knowing the ending, knowing who his real identity is, which you just said, but watch it a second time, and the performance he gives is so lived in that he is playing both parts. It's an amazing piece of work. In every single scene, he is not only playing the part he's supposed to be playing, but he's playing the guy playing the part. It's such a quiet performance. It's not noticeable until the second time around. I love that performance. So, yeah, I've been blessed with, boy, Amy Ryan and Gone Baby Gone, Ed Harris and Gone Baby Gone, Sean Penn, Tim Robbins. Yeah, you know, Marcia Gay Harden.
Most people don't know, though, and I didn't, that it goes, you've got to hook the screenwriter, who hooks the actor, who hooks the director. It's a kind of...
No, every time it's... it's not always how it happens. I mean, with Mr. Gribber, I hooked the director. It was Clint Eastwood, came to me, and said, I want to do this, and I'm going to do this clean, and I'm going to do this really faithful, and this is a tragedy, and we're going to stick to that, and... I said, okay. And he said, now I'm going to get a screenwriter. He went and got the screenwriter. Boom, they knock out the script. And then he said, okay, now I'm going to get my actors. That's how that works. That's personally how I think it should work, but it doesn't most times. Most times it's the studio gets it, and then they go and they hire a screenwriter, and they go through countless drafts, and that are judged by committee. And then ultimately they say, okay, now we've got this one draft that pleased 18 out of the 22 people in the executive offices. So who's on our Rolodex of directors? Then they go get a director, or they say, who's on our Rolodex of stars? I find it just a backward process. It's not something that... I get that it's a battle between art and commerce. I understand that. And I understand the commerce part. And I do truly understand it. And I'm not a rebel against it. But once we've accepted what the commerce end of things is, let the artists go be the artists. That's what you pay them for. And you see a lot of bad films because they don't follow that path.
It can't be easy to find Clint Eastwoods all over Hollywood.
It's almost impossible. But I've been very lucky. He found me. He found me. He tracked me down. He read the book. He read the book through a friend of his, a cardiologist. He was over his house, and he saw the book sitting on a table. And he had just read a review of it that day. And he said, oh, can I borrow that? Which I thought was hilarious. He borrowed the book. And he read the book and called me that weekend, tracked me down, and said, I really want to do this. And he kind of courted me for a little bit because I didn't want to sell it. But we just kept going back and having these great conversations. He's a master of, no matter if you ever say no to Clint Eastwood, what he says is, he says, oh, I totally understand now, and then continues talking. He just, it's brilliant. I've seen him do it person after person. He's absolutely brilliant that way. So I just kept saying it's not for sale, and he kept saying, oh, I understand that, I understand that. But if it were, and then he'd go on to a conversation.
And who are you holding up for?
Nobody. I didn't want to sell it. I didn't want to see it on the screen. I didn't think it was going to make a good movie. I thought they'd misunderstand it. I thought they'd slap a happy ending on it. I thought that nobody was going to get that it's, you know, that it's a classical. It was structured under classical tragedy. I mean, it was structured as a classical tragedy, gift wrapped in a noir. And I didn't think anyone's going to get that. And if you don't get that, then you're not going to get it. I'm going to be really honest here. And I've said this, and so it's not like news, but I don't think I tell terribly original plots. My plots are a dime a dozen. You can find the plot of any Patrick Kensey novel on any of the 108 versions of Law & Order that are on TV right now. You can find the plot of Mystic River in 30 old Jimmy Cagney movie, Pat O'Brien movie, Humphrey Bogart movie. It's just, the plot's out there. Shutter Island's about the only original plot I've ever written. My plots are not, excuse the word, novel. It's execution. It's depth of character, I hope. And maybe it's something to do with, you know, other issues. And so I can't explain the success of my films. I'm always like, really? Scratching my head. No kidding.
The plot of Shutter Island still has my head spinning. I can't imagine quite how you put those two sides of the mirror together, but you did.
Yeah. Shutter Island's the only book, all of it came to me in one night. I wrote it all down, got up the next day, saw it written out.
What was it you wrote down?
The plot. I mean, I wrote down basically every major event that happens in that book, I wrote down that night. Every major event, every big one. Hmm. And then I just connected the dots, which it's the way a lot of people write. I can't write that way. So I had to write the book blazingly fast because I knew I was going to get bored. I don't like knowing what's going to happen, everything that's going to happen. I like to know one thing that's going to happen. I don't like to know everything that's going to happen when I write.
Dennis, you've always been so wonderfully ambitious. I'm wondering what's the next mountain. And you've done everything you could have hoped for. I think these books will be read after you're gone, after we're all gone. But
wow, thanks.
What are the next ones?
I can't do something unless on some level it scares the hell out of me. I just can't. I don't know when I got into that pattern. I think it was early in my career. But I just kept having to say, okay, where haven't I gone now? And sometimes that even means people say, well, why did you go back to a private eye novel? Because I didn't know if I could. It had been 11 years since I wrote one. I wasn't sure I could write one again. I wasn't sure I could write a straight mystery again. I wasn't sure I could do Patrick Kensey again. All of a sudden, I woke up one day afraid of that and said, well, I know what I'm doing next. I don't know. The next project, I just finished a script, moving on to an adaptation of a nonfiction book with a friend of mine for HBO. And then I go to a pilot. I sold a pilot to FX, and I'll be going into that. And that's terrifying, the thought of that. And then the next book is a continuation of some of the characters from The Given Day. So I'm pretty much, I think I'm booked solid to about 2015.
Sounds like it. Yeah. What did writing for The Wire do for you?
It did any number of things. One of the first things it did was it taught me how to write for TV, which I didn't know when I went in there. David Simon, who created the show, showed a lot of faith in us by hiring a bunch of novelists to write for the show and then being really nice enough to school us because we didn't know what the hell we were doing. I mean, we'd seen a lot of TV, but you try and compress 58 beats, which is usually plot points, 58 beats into 58 minutes. That's hard. It's really hard. And five different, you know, usually like five different storylines we were working with on The Wire every episode. I never had a clue how to do that. And like a novelist, I have people talk too much, way too much. Because in a novel, people can talk for a paragraph or two. TV, they can't. You just got to get to it and get in and get out. So one, it taught me how to write for TV. It taught me how to write screenplays. And this was not true when we were writing it. When we were writing The Wire, this is what we knew. We were the lowest rated TV show on premium cable. And we were losing viewers by the hundreds of thousands every season. They just abandoning us every season, more and more and more.
Pre-cult.
It was pre-cult. And it was the end of season four that the show began to suddenly become The Wire in capital letters. And then as season five, when they knew we were ending it, and we were very upfront about it, this is our last season, nobody's bringing us back, then it became something different. And then it went overseas, and it became a cause célèbre in several countries.
And then my kids gave me the box sets.
And a lot of people discovered it on DVD. And suddenly it went from, oh, you work for TV? What do you do? I work for a TV show called The Wire. What network's that? To, you work for the what? You work for The Wire? You know, it just became this, we didn't know it was going to be taught at Harvard. You know, so it changed everything in a lot of ways. Suddenly, we were the writers everybody wanted in TV, certainly in quality TV. I mean, a lot of people came after us. I've had a lot of discussions with the great premium cable networks. You know, HBO, AMC, Showtime, FX, and because there's some right now, TV is a writer's medium. Right now, TV is going through the greatest renaissance it's ever had. It is better now. I think TV is better now than it's ever been. Mm. I used to say, except for the 50s, now I've cut off the second half of the sentence because I don't think in the 50s they weren't doing shows as great as Mad Men and The Sopranos and Breaking Bad, Nurse Jackie. It's just revolutionary what's going on out there right now.
You make me wonder how David Simon knew how to write those sequences. I think of
He'd been schooled on Homicide. They schooled him on Homicide.
Okay.
He sold his book, Homicide, which is a nonfiction book, to Barry Levinson. They made a TV show out of it, and they brought him aboard and said, we'd like you to try some scripts. So he was schooled on Homicide by some great writers, like Paul Ananasio and who was the other big one? Tom Fontana. They schooled David. David then hooked up with Ed Burns, a former Baltimore cop, to write The Corner. That led to The Wire, which led to us. They didn't want writers who'd been taught too much by TV writing.
I was just thinking, though, of David Simon, ex-newspaper guy. I'm an ex-newspaper guy. I think of The Wire in many ways as kind of his revenge on the newspaper.
It wasn't the fifth season.
No, but his declaration that you can't get the story, even of your own town, in the Baltimore Sun, and maybe not in the Boston Globe, which also leads me to ask you, I mean, could you do... Who's going to do a Wire around Boston or around some other accent, some other harbor?
I don't know. It's going to take a little time because nobody wants the next... If you did a show like The Wire right now, you would fail miserably in comparison. Who wants to be the pale imitation of the great work? So I don't think anybody's going to touch it for a little bit. I hope that... People continue to write collectively about cities. I love writing about cities. I'm an urban writer. At the end of the day, that's where I feel most comfortable. So, you know, who knows? But The Wire, looking at the absolute heart and soul, or lack thereof, of a modern metropolis, it's been done. David did it. You know, I don't know that anybody needs to do it again. You know, because Baltimore wasn't just Baltimore. Baltimore was an absolute microcosm of every post-1970s American city, that American metropolis, a big city, that is drowning. You know, that has lost its infrastructure. It's lost its manufacturing base. It's lost its waterfronts because they've been privatized, because they've been, you know, sent up the river to down the river to North Carolina, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, he was looking at why cities have begun to fail. And so, I don't know. I've heard they do some interesting things on Detroit 187, but it's not the same thing. But they're looking. They're trying to look at Detroit a little bit.
Mm.
So,
were you saying you see your own future writing television?
No, I see it as part of my future. Definitely. Definitely. I'd like to do television and books.
Mm.
Television, this is something I think is a really nice distinction that I only figured out recently. Television right now, long-form television, not episodic television, but long-form television like The Wire or Lost or Mad Men, is completely a novelist medium. It's perfect because these are novels for television. Movies and episodic television are more for people who have the short story writer's flair, which I do not have. I've tried, but it's very hard for me. I need a sort of gradual unfolding, a long unraveling of my stories. That makes, you give me 13-episode television arc, which is the standard cable arc. Network, it's 24. I don't know how the hell they do that. But cable is standard cable arc is 13 episodes. I can see it. I just go, that's just like a novel. I get that. I can do that. So, it's attractive to me.
You're in Boston, what, half the time now?
Yeah, six and six.
What is a novelist I see around your own town?
Right now, I think it's like a lot of cities. I'm interested to see how this new Gilded Age is going to fall out. This, you know, people are being priced out of everywhere. I mean, you know, they're being priced out of Charleston. They're being priced, Charleston, completely. You know, they're being priced out of Southie. We have entered something that's similar. It's going on in New York. I see it, you know, happening. Nobody can afford to live in the Village anymore, even the East Village, you know. We are entering this new Gilded Age, and it's kind of horrifying, and I want to see what it's going to say about cities as we get on. And all of a sudden, the only people who can live in a city are people making seven figures. It's going to be interesting.
Dennis Lehane, thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very, very
much. Are we going to eat? You guys down
with
that? I'd
love to.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.